Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time, Whip Six Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh no!
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
Oh! Scores! What? What?
You gotta get the ball to 42.
Run Lacrosse!
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I am Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse. We're almost at the midway point of the 2024 PLL season. After week four, the first neutral site venue of the season. All four teams finally play all at once, all in one weekend. Chris, what's going on? How are you? How'd you enjoy the weekend games?
I am great. It was an interesting weekend. And, you know, this league kind of has a way of keeping things interesting. And, you know, just when there was a possibility of us seeing a little bit of separation, you know, some teams kind of moving ahead of the pack and some teams falling behind, you know, you get a couple teams stringing very important wins together, you know, a couple teams, say, for example, like the Water Dogs. We'll get into all of them later, but, you know, they're off the schneid, and then you get the Atlas, who were up top, kind of getting closer to the pack, and everything gets shaken up again. It's kind of par for the course around here.
What lacked in dramatic finishes made up for with some intriguing storylines in each game, and we'll quickly run through some of the recaps through this weekend, and just to give you an overall overview of this episode of the podcast, where the All-Star game in Louisville, the ballots closed tonight, fan voting. We're recording this on Sunday night, and we're going to give you fans our ballots and who we picked for All-Star teams. Fun little wrinkle with the East and West this season. But before we get to that, undefeated teams no longer. The Whip Snakes, Shock, New York Atlas. I just watched the replay on this one. Chris, I'll lean on you more of the second game of Friday night's doubleheader, but this was a fascinating one. I'm starting to, as much as I was like, who can run with the Bulls last week? I'm starting to raise some alarm bells with that kind of performance. Chris, what did you make of Maryland's upset win for their second straight win of the season against Atlas this weekend?
Yeah, you know, I guess we kind of have to take our feet. You don't even have to completely take our feet off the gas as far as the Atlas bandwagon goes, right? But just, you know, maybe slow it down a little bit. There isn't going to be this steamrolling of every single team in the league as we've seen previously. You know, heading into this weekend, they were winning their games by, I think, 4.75 goals or something like that, and not a whole lot of suspense through most of them. But, you know, the Whip Snakes found a way to shake it up, and sort of an interesting wrinkle in this one was we're starting to see, you know, in-season rematches now, right? And so they had a little bit of a difference between this Whip Snakes team as opposed to the first Whip Snakes team that the Atlas got to face off against. They really shook up their lineups. You know, Jim Stagnita was not going to be pleased with the first matchup. He was not pleased with a lot of production that his team has been putting forward.
Absolutely. They shake up the lineup with an injection of the youth movement. Matt Kinnear wrote about it in his Friday night game stories, and Jim Stagnita really harping on the young guys and bringing them into this lineup. Most notably, Levi Anderson falling out. The swim move over Danny Logan reverberated over social media over the weekend with the great finish in tight, and then the double hitch move to get to the middle of the field with that left hand of his. He's such a smooth player. Adam Poitras comes in from Loyola to make his pro debut. Kevin Winkoff provided a great spark in his second year technically, but his really first real run of action in the Whip Snakes uniform. You saw the couple goals TJ Malone had in that second quarter, swimming past his opponent and really getting inside his kind of bread and butter at such a silky dodger when he can get inside the teeth of the defense like that. it's funny watching the evolution of it, right? A couple of years ago, every GM and defensive coordinator in the league was game planning how to stop Zed Williams and Matt Rambo, and now they're the ones picking their spots and trying to figure out how they can work off these young guys and really help the Whipsnakes propel this momentum going forward. So these rivals, the Whips and Atlas, officially split the season series here. And a reminder that the East and West standings, each squad will play the teams in your conference twice throughout the regular season, and the teams in the West for these two, they'll play them once throughout the regular season. So they already got those two out of the way. And the reason why I think so, it is great for Whipsnakes youth injection and building momentum with a second straight win. But the headline from this one, I think, is sounding some alarm bells with the Atlas. It's still early in the season, and you built a 4-1 record out of the gates here. So no real cause for concern in terms of overall view, but you definitely want to start worrying about some things that crept back from the previous season. Trevor Baptiste doesn't look fully healthy. He started taking some faceoffs off in that second half, and the offensive efficiency in the 32-second shot clock situations were not very good when it was not in Jake Stephens' stick. What a great pro debut from the former Princeton Tiger and Syracuse grad student this season. But another rookie I want to shout out, Jack Corus. He's playing both sides of the ball. He had some really good defensive, disruptive plays throughout the game. But yeah, just finishing up my kind of train of thought there, just the fact that Atlas turned the ball over three times at the end of that game. Really unnecessary turnovers and unforced turnovers at that. They were, and we'll get to this with the Redwoods recap and their third straight loss to open the season. But the margins in this league are so razor thin that you can't have sequences like that. And especially when it's 5 minutes left, you're only down three. You got a chance to kind of start cutting into the deficit here. Atlas, you make some easy unforced plays at the midline on the ride, and Heacock scores that behind the back goal as a result right away. You can't have those mistakes because every team is so good in settled sets on really both sides of the ball in this league. It's really the little things and the tiny mistakes that really do you in. So a little reminiscent of some of their losses from last season, but again, four wins already for them, so no need to really have too much concern as we shift into the second game on Friday night. Two-pointers galore. PLO record, 5 two-pointers. Rosie, oh my goodness, the Cannons living up to their name. What did you make of this one? Boston taking it over the defending champs.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes when it rains, it pours, right? And I think that's kind of how at least the sort of two-point situation can be explained. You know, after the game, Chris Bates did not seem overly concerned. There was certainly no talk about, you know, hey, we got to get this Dobson guy out of there. He has certainly established a resume for himself over this past year and change, that he is their guy, and for good reason. In this particular day, he got lit up from these outside shots. And, you know, like, it is really, you should have seen how unconcerned Chris Bates was about the whole thing. He was like, look, yeah, you know, sometimes that happens. They're not throwing any strategies away or anything. They're liking what they have, and this particular game just didn't work out for them. And, you know, from a defensive standpoint, I completely agree with them. You know, like, yeah, you know, stuff happens, right? So they're just kind of chalking that up to a loss and moving on. Not a great deal of concern for those kinds of shots. You know, 5 two-pointers is largely unprecedented in pro lacrosse. It definitely is in the PLL, and you know, a couple times in the MLL when there are more opportunities, we saw a few of them. But yeah, it's this weird thing, and they're not, you know, sometimes you can get beaten so badly in one particular area that it's almost like not something you're going to worry about happening in the future. You know, if they gave up two pointers and then, you know, maybe we're awful in a two-man game or defending from X or something like that, then yeah, that's kind of how you have to stand in and shake some things up. But from that standpoint, no, he was fine with it, and the defense was fine with it as well, especially with Graham Hossick coming back in the lineup. They looked good otherwise.
The Matt Campbell, cans a couple. Chris Laning gets one to go from beyond as well, but one of the best mid-range shooters in all of the PLL, in Ryan Drenner, extending his game from beyond the arc, was fun to watch. Insert the John Wall audio of not knowing he had that in his arsenal, because that was super fun.
I ain't never ever seen you act like this before. You getting buckets. How you feel?
Rosie, just you mentioned not being concerned with the Archers' defensive performance. What about offensively? What did you take away from how they did and how they fared against this Cannons group? And really, they've had some stretches in the second half of each game so far this season. Any changes you would make on that end of the field?
Yeah, offensively, there is a little cause for concern at this point. They're not quite looking as productive as they have in the past, and particularly kind of saddled with a lot of unforced turnovers. That was one of the things that really did them in this particular matchup. Just passing errors, you know, the things that you expect not to see at this level, especially from the defending champs. As far as changes going forward, I think you saw a little bit of it towards the latter portion of this game, right? Grant Ament, who had been playing midfield, even though, you know, he's clearly stated that that's not what he would love to do in this world, right? He is an attackman who's kind of stuck in that position playing midfield. Eventually, they have kind of decided, yeah, we're going to move him back down. And so he starts playing attack a little bit more in this game, and he is absolutely shredding Boston defense with his passing. You know, he's just getting everybody involved, making, you know, like traditional aimant passes, you know what I mean? Like the skip passes, the underhanded stuff, leading the cutters in a way that really only he can or does. And he's bringing that out. And so they keep him there and they move Matt Moore to midfield. Matt Moore has been entirely unproductive thus far this season. He really hasn't done much of anything. More turnovers this past weekend than points this season, right? So eventually they kind of got to get him out of the fray. And so I would expect in the future, we see a lot more aiming at attack and then a lot more Matt Moore, you know, just playing out the box. And ultimately, you know, just the way it goes here, right? Coming out of the box, but also justifying the start. You know, if he is playing midfield, it's kind of going to be like a relegation for him, right? He's going to lose the attack spot, go to midfield. If not producing midfield, then we'll see if they bring somebody else in. You know, there were some guys who were sitting, and he might lose that spot. You know, maybe we see more Ryan Ogavin and less Matt Moore moving forward. I asked Chris Bates about that after the game as far as, you know, how Amon's going to play going forward. And unsurprisingly, he did not tell me.
Little teaser for our All-Star Game ballots coming up. I do have Grant Ament as my Western Conference, one of the midfielders, because he has been that good. It's a super interesting discussion for all the reasons that you just stated. Matt Moore not performing to the standard he set the last few seasons. But also, Connor Fields is starting to, the last few weeks, get the brunt of criticism that he received during his chaos days and holding on to the ball too long, disrupting the flow of the offense and the selflessness of the passing movement. So seeing both attack units and kind of rotating in that Ament more Mac line versus Ament Mac and Fields will be super interesting. And I know Bates will try them both out. There's mismatches somewhere, right? You've got the best midfielder in the world in Tom Schreiber. So when Ament was playing midfield and he had a couple goals earlier in the game with getting to the middle of the field with his right hand and getting some low shots to go, he can terrorize these short stick defensive midfielders. I know you're going to harp some praise on Ryan Tarasenko later, but when they played the Outlaws, he just took him for a dance on that wing and swam past him, sent a riser earlier in the season. So Amen's been top of his game this year, and he's playing really motivated, so it's fun to watch. Moving on to the Saturday games, the kind of hinted at the Redwoods woes. 0-3 start now to start this 2024 season, and a lot of worries. The offense isn't clicking. They were tying 8 at the end of the third quarter. Do not score in the final frame. Rosie, just some of these transition turnovers are unacceptable at this level. And Nat St. Laurent said as much post game. Really takes you out of the flow of the offense, and they've got weapons to hurt these teams if they can just get into a rhythm one of these games, you know? So seeing the Outlaws win another one was, I think, super entertaining, with Bundy catching the hot hand and Sam Hanley upping his passing skills and kind of taking some pressure off Brendan O'Neill with the Redwoods defense being super sound structurally and sliding early too. But any takeaways you have from just the Redwoods' poor start to the season so far?
They had the kind of, I would kind of categorize it as like high school ball turnovers versus like professional turnovers that are like in the flow of making something good happen. Really unacceptable and very difficult to win. And it's not going to get any easier for them either, right? If you can't get an advantage on the way that the Outlaws were presenting themselves in this game, it's going to be very difficult to bring the same output to some of the other teams in the league and expect to walk away with a victory. So now the real question, I think, is what's their strategy that gets them out of this? You know, like what is the door they take that fixes this? You know, going into this game, they knew, or at least had a good idea, that their attack probably was not going to be as productive. We'd seen it in years past, especially last year. We'll probably get into a little bit more, but JT Giles-Harris matchup on Rob Pinnell has favored Giles-Harris significantly. So he's going to need some help from some other people, namely midfielders. But in this particular game, you were looking at Romar Dennis being like the only midfielder who put up goals. And, you know, that is not a consistently reliable source of production, right? You know, two pointers from Romar Dennis is not something they count on game after game to take place. So, you know, if he's your only midfielder scoring and you know that your star attackman is going to be essentially shut off the board completely, or literally, as he was in this case, then it is going to be a very long day for you. And it was for them, you know, scoring droughts of up to 20 minutes or so, right? So, so the question is, can they get out of this? And it's really going to, I think, come down to what they can get out of that midfield.
Times has been a little bit frustrating, right? To say the least, trading the number 5 overall pick in one of the best drafts of all time. They had quite a few options to take either Liam Entman and upgrade that position at the end of the field, or take a guy like Matt Brandau, or Pat Cavanaugh was still on the board at that point. Like, there was tons of talent available, and there's still time to turn things around for this Redwoods group. You saw like Garrett Degnan wasn't as involved in the scoring column this game, and although Charlie Bertrand did have one of the best assists of the season so far with that one-handed scoop pass through over top the help defense. That was awesome, but you hit the nail on the head. Just need more midfield production. Last year was Cole Kirst. This year, they need more guys to step up.
You know what I was thinking when I was watching this game? I was like, you know who they could really use in that midfield? Levi Anderson. Unfortunately, they shipped him over to the Whipsnakes. So this weekend was not a good weekend for the Redwoods on or off field kind of strategy wise. I mean, because we just discussed Anderson looking pretty good.
Not a great weekend on and off the field for California, but it was for Denver, second one of the season. And Tim Sudan said it best in his post-game press conference. This is kind of room. The defense, a veteran group, the offense, very young. When they eat team meals together, they're starting to heckle each other and loosen up. So it's fun playing for a guy like Tim Sudan who kind of gets the locker room culture right and then worries about the X's and O's, and the X's and O's are in good shape when you have two of the best midfielders in recent memory from the college game just playing out of their minds. Sam Hanley did not record assist the first three games of the season. He has four helpers on the Saturday night, and none so more indicative of things going out Outlaw's way than his fourth when it was totally checked out of his stick and it ends up right to Cross Ferrara. Shout out Delaware. And he scores his second goal of the game. But the other three assists were quite indicative of the chemistry that these two middies are having together. So Sam Hanley feeds Grant Bundy three times for three different step downs. And that's so fun to watch. Watching these guys at Penn and Georgetown through the years, like, I never would have thought it would have ended up like this, where they would end up on the same pro midline, because they were just all Americans every season at the college level. So seeing that continue to rise, and it's going to be fun to watch. Those guys are two of the best in their position as the younger crew. And it was cool to hear Tim Sudan kind of harp praise on Hanley as a second year guy, already taking some leadership qualities into the huddle on the sidelines and into the locker room. So props to Sam Hanley for expanding his game with some playmaking and passing and all that. But, you hit it. JT Giles Harris, another stellar performance. Let's go to the final game of the weekend with the Water Dogs pulling away from the Carolina Chaos with a 10-6 scoreline. Bit of a snooze fest for some points if you're not big fans of the defensive end in this game. The goalie battle was tremendous between Dylan Ward and Blaze Reardon as the championship pedigree between those two. And Rosie, it's one of my favorite individual matchups of the season, not just those two guys, but the Jack Rowlett, Michael Sowers matchup. Seeing those two go at it in person from Subaru Park in the championship a few years back, and just every game since, you really see it has a kind of championship pedigree feel to it. And really, it was the complimentary guys that stepped up. Kieran McArdle getting a couple helpers, the Connor Kelly and Ryan Conrad, the back away from the double team out of pressure was a great highlight of the game. And but the defense stepped up. Chaos offense, like the Redwoods, you hit the worry button. So, Rosie, what'd you see from both these teams, and especially that Chaos offense?
Well, first of all, let me tell you my absolute favorite part of the game. It actually took place right when the game ended, and the camera caught Bill Tierney on the sideline. Now, you know, there've been a lot of talk from several people saying, you know, Water Dogs are right there. No panic yet. And that's certainly true, I think, right? And rightfully so, because we know that, you know, 0-3 isn't a death sentence in this league, especially for a team like this. We've seen them come back from this sort of thing before. But that being said, right after the game, camera cuts to Bill Tierney. He's on the sideline. Right after that whistle blows, you can see him mouthing, "It's about effing time." And, you know, Bill had been very cool about it. Say, you know, hey, we're, you know, taking the whole one game at a time approach and nobody's too worried and this and that and this and that, you know, weird bounces and it is what it is. But, you know, it ultimately comes down to wins and losses. So quote of the week, if you ask me, Bill Tierney, coaching legend, "It's about effing time." Now, as far as the chaos offense goes, there is reason for concern there, right? Another performance, I think the lowest scoring total in the league prior to this game was chaos the week before. And that was 7 goals from Carolina in their last game. And then they only make it to 6 this time. So, you know, I think it's kind of wild that this could be the possibility. After last season, you would think this would be ridiculous to say, but it really looks like Sergio Perkovic's absence from the offense has just kind of sunk in it as far as, you know, top-down productivity goes. You know, last year we're looking at a guy who was out of the lineup most of the time and unable to put any points on the board, but the start he had to this season was, you know, vintage Motor City Hitman kind of stuff, right? 2 2-pointers, 6 points total in his first 3 games. But then he has an ankle injury that makes him doubtful for week 3 and then out for good in week 4, you know? So I'm very curious to see when he's going to get back in the lineup or if somebody's going to replace him, because a team like Carolina that was so reliant on a presence like Dane Smith, you know, you get that. And I know they've mentioned, you know, tinkering with their offense and kind of changing the approach, but still there's only so much you can do with a downhill dodger like Dane Smith, who's always got his eyes up, ready to make the pass. It just terrifies opposing defenses. They know they're going to have to slide. They know they're going to have to rotate, and they know he can feed it 98 miles an hour right into somebody's stick, like a Josh Byrne or whoever's, you know, on the receiving end of it. Now, you're not going to replace Dane Smith with anybody, right? Because he's Dane Smith. But maybe they can get 2 guys who can be half as productive or something like that. And you see it in flashes. You see it in flashes from some of their guys, some of the rookies they've put in place. You know, I think Dobson's been especially strong. You know, you've seen it from some other gentlemen like Knobloch. But yeah, it's a matter of putting it all together and getting the threats generally north-south, I think. This was a big weekend overall for kind of people needing midfield productivity. It just kind of seemed like there was a drought from a lot of teams as far as getting the threats who can come down in the north-south fashion like that. Question I have for you, what do you think? Do you think maybe at some point here we see Andy Towers say, "Hey, listen, Jules Henenberg, I know when you signed the contract and, you know, tweeted about it, you specifically said #attack, but, you know, about that, what if he goes back to midfield? Like, is that a step in the wrong direction? That 6 of 1, half dozen of the other? Do they maybe get stronger with him coming from the midfield, inverting from time to time? And, you know, maybe you keep like Byrne, Minikis, and Ross Scott in on attack. Does that do anything? You know, I'm trying to find something for these guys.
I'm not sure that makes the biggest difference. Because you look at the options that you would replace him with, and then I think it takes away their production. Brian Minikis has a team high 3 points, only on 9 touches, 2 goals, 1 assist, and a couple other guys in that position. Ross Scott, he's had a strong start to his rookie campaign, not so much the last couple games, but I think whoever you're bringing out of the box is the one going to get those touches and try to exploit the mismatches from behind. And some praise is due for the short stick defensive midfield this weekend. Like, yeah, the offensive midfielders weren't producing, but like guys like Matt Wicher are playing out of their minds right now. Like Matt Wicher, they talked about on the broadcast a little bit. He he's a guy like you should not be dodging on. He's standing you up on GLE and taking it away, taking it the other way, and he's a threat to score in transition too. So I know we got the Matt Richard fan club and he's inside the crawl circles, but he's playing some legit ball this summer. So I think so. It kind of goes both ways, right? Like, you got to set some of these guys up for better success. And I think the mic'd up moment when Andy Towers was yelling at Eric Dobson, get in the right spot. Like, some of these offensive woes aren't down to the coaching. Like, they're telling the players to execute these things, and you're seeing it totally not go their way. So some growing pains on that end of the field, but you're right. I mean, I missed the headline of the win. Bill Tierney, the 7-time national champion, finally getting in the win column, joking throughout the offseason that he just doesn't want to screw this culture up. It's been a championship pedigree squad for the last few seasons now under Andy Copeland's stewardship. He steps down. Tierney comes in. So, coincidentally, the first game that they dress a face-off guy, Rosie, Alex Stathakis, into the lineup from his mastery of the Denver Pioneers graduate program that he was part of, finishing up his exams and right into the lineup. He goes 8-for-18 against Nick Rowlett. Kind of a good matchup for him in terms of both being power guys. Nick Rowlett's not quite in that upper echelon of elite guys, T.D. Erlin, Joe Nardella, Trevor Baptiste types. So it was a good debut to see, all right, what can you give us against a guy like Rowlett? It was worth it for all the reasons that we mentioned on the last episode of the cascading compounding effects of the defense getting tired, but also your efficiency in that you never want to just give the ball away 31 straight times in a game. So seeing them get more possessions was certainly helpful in getting out the first result of the season for the Dogs. Rosie, let's move right along to our All-Star Game ballots here. The voting closed on Sunday night as we enter the Week 5 play. It's a bit of a unique situation in terms of not a lot of the season has been played to this point, so it's still hard to tell who's going to make those All-PLL teams at the end of the season. But let's get right to it. Let's read off our respective Eastern and Western ballots, and I think we can say a few words on the spots we disagree with. So, my Eastern ballot, the way the PLL voting system has it set up, it's 2 attack, 2 midfield, 1 face-off, 2 defense, and 1 goalie. So, 1 specialist each and 2 in all of the standard positions. So Jeff Teat, we both have him as our starting Eastern Conference attackman. Leading the league in scoring, he's the easy pick, the front runner for the MVP so far. We disagree with our second attack spot. So it's you got Michael Sowers, Chris. I'm going with Xander Dickson. He's leading the league in goals so far. I think what he's meant to this offense, and he's already surpassed his rookie goal tally he's running out of the box with Eric Law healthy last season. What he's meant to this offense has been invaluable, and his off-ball movement kind of sparks the selflessness and willingness to share the ball for that Atlas group. Midfield-wise, I got Matt Campbell. Docs Aiken is someone you disagree with. You've got Miles Jones on your ballot. Gavin Adler, Matt Dunn. You're going with Colin Squires on the Whips, which is a pretty cool pick, in my opinion. And then goalie-wise, It was kind of tough because I think the best goalies this season are in the West. So I went with Colin Kerst. He had a rough first game of the season, and he's been above 50% or more every other game. Dylan Ward, but he's not allowed to stay in the crease all game. Just high crease, go above the entire crease line and try to stop shots like that. He was basically out of his crease all game, keeping the Chaos Shooters guessing on Saturday night. And it worked. Best performance of the season, above 60%, 12 saves. He's 3% better than my pick, Colin Kerst. Again, I think that first game has kind of overshadowed his recent run of holding teams under 10 goals or less for Boston. So as we check out the I forgot to mention our face-off spot. You've got Trevor Baptiste. I've got Joe Nardella. That 31 for 31 display, it was very, very much inflating his value of leading the league so far, but just his return, the feel good factor, it's been good to see him back. And he won the battle last time out against Baptiste, and Baptiste just, he's not 100%, you can tell. And as a result, I think you should probably take the All-Star game weekend off. Let's get some rest and get ready for the second half of the season.
Well, that's his thing, right? Like, that is the historical precedent we've seen with Trevor Baptiste. He is going to show, he is going to not play, but he is also going to win the All-Star game. That is his annual thing. He's going to show up, and he is just going to, he's going to be mic'd up on the sideline. He is going to lead the league in fun, and his team is probably going to win. His team always wins, and he is always, you know, the guy who walks away victorious, and he just doesn't even suit up anymore. So, yeah, it is probably going to be Joe Nardella in that game, but Trevor Baptiste will be hanging out on the sideline, living his life similar to a fashion like we see him in the Cash App commercials, buying fancy clothes and partying and eating steaks and drinking.
Now, I usually favor the attackmen who are the quarterbacks, the driving force of the offense. Michael Sowers is exactly that. His assist opportunities for this Water Dogs group is off the charts. The finishing hasn't been to their standard so far this season. That's why the 0-3 start was mostly in place. So I do like that you picked him for your squad, Rosie, but Xander Dickson has just been so fun to watch off ball, and Jeff Teat kind of fit that mold. I wanted kind of one of each of having that guy who initiates the offense as well as the Xander Dickson, and maybe it's a little bit of a recency bias just watching the Atlas replay. Even though they lost, just another great game from Xander Dickson, up to 15 goals on the season. Exact same with your Miles Jones pick. He's got 4 assists. Docs does not have any. So he's also got a couple 2-pointers in there. And I do agree that he maybe would be the more fun player in an All-Star setting. So I do like that reasoning a lot. And that's what it's for. This is a game for the fans. And we want some cool special talent that have some special plays in Louisville. On to the West, I've got Brennan O'Neill and Josh Byrne as my two attackmen. You've got Connor Fields and Josh Byrne. So, splitting hairs, I think, there with really Brennan O'Neill's got the one quarter working for him in that fourth quarter rather than the 3 games sample size so far. But midfield-wise, I mentioned it earlier, I've got Grant Ament. We both have the reigning MVP, Tom Shriver. But I'll give you the floor for a minute to heap some praise on something you've touched on in a past column of yours of, you know, fans should maybe consider voting for Ryan Tarefenko this season.
But for some reason this year, they went back to just grouping them together. And, you know, it kind of creates some sort of wacky situations because, you know, there's no LSM spot. There's no defensive midfield spot. So you have some guys kind of going against each other that really do very different jobs from one another. So what I did here with this pick is I gave it to Ryan Tarasenko. I just think he is a difference maker in transition, solid defense, and in particular, which we did see quite a bit in this past Redwoods game, he is certainly not afraid to start the offense himself. You know, he had a goal that was waved off because of like an interference call that had happened, kind of required them to blow the whistle. It was a weird situation. You know, they didn't even know exactly why the game was stopped at the time. But anyway, it was a nice goal that didn't even end up counting. And then he had a great assist later on. So he's not afraid to be a part of the offense. So really, one spot like that. And this is another roster that kind of changed a little bit throughout the time. My first All-Star ballot was different from this one. I had O'Neal in there. I took O'Neal out after this past weekend. You know, if he's in there, I'm certainly not going to complain about it, right? I mean, that one quarter you mentioned was so phenomenal that, you know, if you have a three-game sample size, okay, yeah, sure, put him in. I'm fine with that. You know, this past game, he took five shots. Does it mean he's not good? Of course not. But if I'm picking my All-Star team, you know, maybe I put Connor Fields up there, who might be, you know, who's been quite productive all year and doesn't really have a conscience when it comes to, you know, shooting the ball between his legs or something like that. So I'll put him in there, put Byrne in there. And yeah, Tarasenko, just not only because of who he is, but I wanted a representative of the position.
No, I love that. Give the mids their love. And we both have Blaze Reardon in net. Big props to TD Erlen this season. He's really coming into his own as what Matt St. Laurent described as the best face-off guy in the league this year, statistically-wise. Although, I think Nardella, because of that inflation, has him on percentage, but TD Erlen has been super special. He has 56 of 80, 35 ground balls, and three goals already, so including that one-handed gem with his offhand. So he's had a great season. Defense was pretty fun to mull over. I chose Warren Jeffery just because I was really impressed with how he replaced that hole left by Graham Hossick being on the holdout list the first few weeks and guarding the opposition's number one. And I think he deserves some credit and due for that. We both agree on JT Giles Harris's impact this season. Shout out Brian Noslax on Twitter. He's a big JT stan. So you've also got Jack Rowlett. So it's always difficult leaving Rowlett off the ballot, but a fun exercise nonetheless for the All-Star game. Let's go and preview the Boston homecoming weekend as we wrap up the episode here. Chris, let's go through each of the four matchups and let's give the fans something to look forward to here, starting with the Redwoods versus Cannons. What's something that you've got your eye on?
Redwoods Cannons, if you are, you know, looking for a reason to tune into that, I would say the first thing that comes to mind for me, Garrett Eppel, for the first time, takes on his old teammates, the California Redwoods. He did not get traded. Just a reminder, he left via free agency this past offseason, signed with the Cannons. And, you know, I got a lot of questions there.
We saw a lot of Arden Cohen get into some skirmishes in their matchup this season. Maybe if Garrett Eppel is getting into transition, watch out. If Arden Cohen is in the vicinity, that could be some fireworks in terms of how that shakes out. I'm looking forward to seeing how that third attack spot shakes out. We've seen Matt Cavanaugh at the beginning of the year left off this week for Mike Robinson. Pat Cavanaugh was out with an injury with his right groin strain and left toe. It's a really interesting spot to keep track of, and I've written about it since the preseason. That'll be something I continue to watch in that game as we move on to the Outlaws versus New York Atlas matchup. Rosie, this one has got storylines, and none other than the first overall pick versus the second overall pick. How can you describe the excitement going into this one?
Yeah, this is, our superstar versus superstar. The whole debate over who you take first overall. We saw how that went and how it has gone. We have seen, right out the gate, Schellenberger has the huge game. We have to wait till game two for Brendan O'Neill to have his signature game, but he's had that one as well. So now we're going to see them both on the same field. And yeah, the whole matchup leading up to this, I'm sure a lot of the promo, if the graphics department isn't already working on both of their faces on the same material, I would be very surprised. You know, you got to see number one versus number two. They're going to be tied together until one of them retires, I think, right? So they're kind of our Magic versus Bird. They're our Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese right now. Like, this is what we have. And it's going to be very exciting. They're never going to be against each other physically, you know, because they're on different sides of the ball. I mean, on different sides of the field the whole time, of course. But still, there is going to be a tracker on the screen that says, you know, Schellenberger points versus O'Neill points. Every play is going to be dissected. It's going to be magnified and analyzed so much. And rightfully so, because they are budding superstars in the league. So, yeah, that's hands down what to watch in this one.
Yeah, just to piggyback off it, like, who defends both of these guys, right? The Atlas defensive personnel, the guy who's really most equipped to guard these big, burly, physical opposing number one attackmen is probably Brett Makar, but I don't think you want Gavin Adler not guarding Brendan O'Neill. So that'll be a good, interesting decision to watch and see how Kevin Arnstein and Mike Pressler game plan for a guy of O'Neill's caliber. Then you look at Schellenberger. Does he go up against a guy who's game planned against him plenty and Jesse Bernhardt? Because JT Giles Harris, I think, is usually primarily focused on playing against Jeff Teat. So pick your poison always with this Atlas offense with all their weapons. But whoever guards Schellenberger is going to have their work cut out for him in week five. Going on to the second day in Boston, the Utah Archers versus the Maryland Whipsnakes. Rosie, what are you checking out for this one?
Well, you know, 5 2-pointers in a game is pretty unprecedented, like I said earlier. So we should not expect Maryland to score 5 2-pointers in this one. That being said, is that kind of added to their pregame scout, right? Do they say somebody like Dobson, you know, was kind of on tilt last weekend after that one? Why don't we drop some bombs from deep and see if we can get to him early? Also, Mike Chanenchuk has been hot from deep, right? He's already got 3 2-pointers that matches last season's total. You know, saying 2022. 21 and 20, he had two. You know, he's known as the deep threat, right? But, you know, you're really generally looking at about two a year, right? But now he's already got three. So it wouldn't surprise me if they kind of do some scheming to, let's get Chanenchuk open to take a few shots from deep, and let's just kind of see where Dobson's head is at coming into this game after getting shelled from Appside last weekend.
Yeah, and you probably want to do that early too. Dobson's not the kind of guy that I think gets in his own head, but if he lets in an early 2-pointer, like first few minutes of that first quarter, like, how could you not, right? You gave up a PLL record the prior week, and you're staring down shooters like Mac Hamill this time. So great call out by you. Just the in terms of other storylines, I hit on it already, so I won't go too deep on it again, but how does Bates shuffle that attack line of inserting Graham back down there for portions of last weekend, and how do you shuffle O'Keefe, Fields, and Moore, and make sure everyone stays happy and gets their touches. So something to track often and always. As we wrap up with the second doubleheader game for the homecoming host themselves, Boston taking on the Water Dogs for a revenge game of the Zach Cucci game. Rosie, let's start there. Just what are you watching for this one?
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I mean, you mentioned Tucci. That was the huge game. He's leading the whole team in scoring, 18 for 24 from the stripe. But this time, of course, the Water Dogs are, well, let me say this. Let me back up for a second. I'm saying they're going to have Alex Dathkis handling the faceoffs. I don't know that for sure, because Bill Tierney is still saying, you know, I don't know. I might go back to not doing it. I don't know. We'll see. Is he being lovably stubborn, or is he playing his strategy close to the vest? I don't know. I'm guessing he's probably going to have a face-off guy in the lineup moving forward.
They scored more goals for that one.
Right. They are undefeated with a face-off guy in their lineup. So I think, I think Stathakis will be there this coming weekend. And if that is in fact the case, I wonder what kind of impact that's going to have. You know, Tucci was running wild last time, and now he's going to have to go against somebody who's got a game under his belt, got a win under his belt, and is going to be a formidable opponent. And maybe that means we'll see a little bit more Zach Currier, you know, run a little more offense. It definitely changed the whole complexion of the Water Dogs offense to have, you know, somebody like Currier not having to take 20 faceoffs, which is nuts for him at this point. So yeah, we'll see how things shake out when they're both bringing guns to a gunfight this time around.
I'm looking out for how Jack Hanna affects this game. His presence was palpable in the matchup this weekend against the Chaos. Already drawing the LSM, the poll matchup, and Tierney spoke about a post game that shifts everyone down in the pecking order. Now Connor Kelly's getting a short stick. Now Zach Currier is always getting a short stick, but especially now with he's getting the second short stick with Jack Hanna in the lineup. His crossfield skip pass over to Connor Kelly was scintillating. I've seen it live when I was watching him at the Team USA tryouts up in Sparks last fall or a couple falls ago. He's really fun when he's on his A game, and you live with the missed shots. He's a volume shooter, but man, he's so athletic, and it really adds an athletic presence in and out to this offense. So, Rosie, I'm looking forward to it. I'll give you the last word. Boston homecoming weekend upcoming. Let's hear it. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I mean, let me just say this. Overall, I'm excited to see what Boston brings to the table. We keep seeing this, obviously not this past weekend because it was a neutral site location, but we keep seeing how important it has been to the teams and to the coaches. Like, everybody is talking about these home environments actually serving their purpose, right? Like, they're feeling like home games to these guys. The coaches have specifically mentioned it, like, you know, yeah, you know, looking out there and seeing the way that it's decorated, it feels like our venue, and it is really making a difference to these guys. Now I want to see what Boston can bring. 4th of July weekend, I imagine, is a pretty big time in Boston anyways. So you know, I think we mentioned on the last podcast, they're one of the teams that has had you know, pre-existing fan base, as opposed to kind of the ones that were created by the league when they kind of realized, hey, we need supporter groups. You know, Boston kind of comes with that already baked in there. So yeah, the pressure is on Boston and the surrounding areas to step up and raise the bar that's kind of being raised at every stage here along the way.
You better bring it, Boom Squad. And better bring it in full force, because we're looking out for you. Can't wait for a fun weekend of PLL Lacrosse coming up. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm Kevin Brown, and thanks so much for listening.